Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and those who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. This is Season 2, sponsored by Park Road Books, the oldest and only independent bookstore in Charlotte. I don't know about you, but I get a good feeling when I'm surrounded by a world of new books, and an even better feeling when I know I'm supporting the local independent bookstore. Consider stopping by Park Road Books for your feel-good experience. You'll meet a friendly staff ready to recommend that next great read, just for you. Speaking of feeling good, I've got a good feeling that you will enjoy our guest author today. So let's get to it. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. In this episode, we meet author Gilda Marina Syverson, a poet, memoirist, and as she says, a member of a large Italian-American family from upstate New York that grows exponentially each year. This Italian-American family has its roots in Sicily, which led to Gilda's quest to learn more about her past and to her award-winning memoir, My Father's Daughter, From Rome to Sicily. Gilda reads from the memoir and discusses the culture and norms of the old country. It's a trip well worth taking. She also reads two poems, and in the spirit of Valentine's Day, she reads a piece called Racing and Wives and Valentines, which is sure to generate a laugh or two. We start first with her poem, A Sicilian Dream, published in Main Street Rag.
A Sicilian Dream. Together with family, we stand, shift, walk the island of our ancestors. A powerboat zooms around. My brother, his wife, and son navigate the vessel. Sometimes they land, travel with the rest of us, up and down mounds, rolling terrain of ground, in and out of crevices, caves, over hills, but not dales. The green dales of earlier dreams no longer present. Instead, our feet hit brown rocks, burnt umber, sienna, ochre, sepia, coffee, tan, russet, dun, every brown that is Italian, the clay of our origins.
Gilda Marina Syverson is an author, poet, artist, speaker who has taught memoir writing classes and workshops for over 19 years, including 15 years at Queen's University before continuing private classes in Charlotte at the Warehouse and Charlotte Center for Literary Arts. Gilda is the author of two poetry books. Her award-winning poems and stories have been published in numerous literary journals, magazines, and anthologies in the USA and Canada. Her memoir, My Father's Daughter, From Rome to Sicily, has taken her back to Italy and Sicily, where she led the tour in the footsteps of My Father's Daughter. Gilda encourages others to capture their family stories for themselves and for future generations. Gilda, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Landis. Yeah, great to be here.
Yeah, so you come from a big Italian-American family.
I do. There are eight children in my family.
Eight children.
Yeah. Right.
A lot of grandchildren now?
There are 18 grandchildren now, yes.
So what's it like growing up in a large Italian-American family?
Busy, yeah. Lots of wonderful food, lots of people around, even other than ourselves, lots of aunts and uncles and cousins running in and out, and yeah. It's busy.
Now, this title on your first piece, A Sicilian Dream, is that something that you always had as a child, a dream to go back to Sicily?
Absolutely. Actually, no.
Really?
I didn't think we would be able to go back to Sicily. You know, my grandparents spoke Italian, and they spoke their dialect, and they did the best they could with English. Some were better than others of the four of them. And I always thought that was something in the past, and that was not something we would ever do. It was not even part of my consciousness, which is probably just as well. Because if it was part of my consciousness, I'd start worrying about it. Mm-hmm. And it just happened.
And when did the urge become greater to go back?
Well, the urge came when I thought I was going to Italy to see the art, you know, because my background was fine arts. And so one summer I planned this trip a whole year ahead of time, took an Italian class, and I really thought that I was going to be going to Italy to see the art and just stop by the villages and see what they look like. And so one of my sisters and a cousin asked if they could go with me, and we landed in Sicily first and went all the way up to northern Italy, and we stopped by there, and I knew when I left there were three things I wanted to do, and one of those was to go back and live in my father's village, and that opportunity came 2 years later.
Now, live, you mean for like a summer?
Not permanently, right. Because as you know in the book, there were things that women couldn't do in those villages. I just wanted to go and see what it felt like to live there.
Yeah, in the book, and we'll get to the book in a minute. This is you wrote a memoir about going back with your father and your mother to Sicily.
Yes.
This poem, though, A Sicilian Dream, was written before that book came out.
It was. Yeah. Well, you know, I really believe in dreams. I belong to the Charlotte Friends of Jung, and I love dream work, and people who are in my poetry group will say, oh, yeah, she shows up with lots of dream poems. But I really feel that I get information. So this came before then. But I had gone to Italy before I went with my parents. I'd been there, like I mentioned, with a sister and a cousin. And then when I went and lived in Italy for one summer, it was with my aunt and uncle who said, we're going back for the last time. And so if you want to go, you're welcome to come and live with us. And so I got to actually live in the village for a month. Of August.
And that prepared you for this idea of taking your father and your mother back?
Well, yes. I'd been begging my father to go for years, and he wouldn't go with me. And my mother never intended on going over there, which is really special for her because she got to meet cousins. And so it prepared. Why? Once I was there, I wanted to go back. I wanted to see what my father knew because my aunts knew so much, but I knew my father knew other things. So it was sort of a preparation of sorts, yes, I think so.
Now, you grew up in Syracuse.
I did.
Right.
Syracuse, New York.
Now, are you fully Southern now?
I should be. I've been here since 1979. Right. I feel like this is home. Yeah. And I had a friend who I taught with who started she's from here, from this area, and she started noticing that we have a lot of the same traditions. We like a lot of the same foods, you know, the greens and things like that.
And your father came over with his parents? Correct?
No, my dad came over. His father was already here.
Okay.
My dad came when he was 15. He came on the boat alone when he was 15. And his mother and two sisters were supposed to come next, and then World War II broke out. So they lived there by themselves while the men, well, dad was in the service, and they tried to get my grandfather was there, but he was too old. They had to send him home.
So you're not that far removed from these brown rocks, this burnt umber, this sienna. Yeah.
Well, you know, my mother was the first child born here. And so I always tell everyone I'm not quite first generation. I'm like a generation and a half. But mom was the first child born. So she was born soon after her mother and brother arrived.
Did your father ever talk about coming to the U.S. as a young boy at age 15? Was that hard for him to do?
Oh, my father was adventuresome.
Yeah.
And I learned when I went over there that they were all the ones that came were adventuresome. I mean, that was a big risk. They thought they'd never see their families again. And so my dad, he was happy to come over. He's 15. You know, you're 15, I'll try anything. So he was happy to come here. I mean, my grandfather was the one who, he wanted to come to make a better life for my father and mother's generation and then for us, but he had always hoped he'd go back there.
Now, this piece, A Sicilian Dream, it was published in Main Street Rag with a collection of numbered dreams about Sicily, right? I mean, it was part of a collection of poems that were titled A Sicilian Dream.
Well, there's a section in that book, yeah.
And so you were thinking a lot about Sicily when you wrote this set of poems in 2011.
Now, this is the interesting thing, if you think about it from a Jungian perspective. Was I thinking, well, I had already been there, so I had been thinking about it, yes. But sometimes things come in our dreams that tell us what we're thinking about, even though we don't have time to think about it in our waking hours. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know what I'm thinking about in my waking hours.
Well, you know, Landis, I mean, I guess I learned this from going to all those Jungian meetings, but I'd already had been there, and once I'd been there, I was hooked.
Right.
You know, I kept wanting to go back. So if I didn't have time to think about it, it would sometimes just show up in a dream.
All right, well, let's go back. You wrote this memoir, My Father's Daughter from Rome to Sicily.
Yes.
It's won all kind of awards. I think it's taken you
places you probably didn't expect it would take you.
I didn't expect it. No, I didn't.
Well, let's get into that a little bit. You're going to read a couple of pieces, starting first with how you sort of tricked your father into going back to Sicily.
Yes.
So let's read that.
Okay, that'll be great. For almost 20 years, I've begged my father to travel with me to the town in Sicily where he was born. Going with Dad, who knows the ins and outs of the customs there, would provide more information than I would ever be able to find on my own. But my father has always made excuses for not going. Early on, he said that he hated puckering up for all those kisses his cousins would expect. Eventually, he switched to, "I could never travel with you. We'd kill each other." There's probably more truth to us killing each other. Dad has always been patriarchal and more conservative. After having left home over 30 years ago, I've discovered a more feminist outlook. It's made for a rather fiery relationship between my father and me. We've argued over women's issues, the hierarchy of the church, and my profession as an artist. I've even reached the point where I refuse to answer my father when he asks how much I made on a piece of art. He's been known to scoff at the amount, throw his hands in the air, and say something irritating about how much more money he makes cutting hair. And I didn't even have all those years of college and graduate school. Dad also squirms when I encourage my mother to stand her ground against him. One day, when I was visiting, my father stood up from the dinner table, like he's always done, and headed for his recliner. "Mary, bring me my coffee," he called out to my mother. Using every expression my eyes and brow would allow, I mouthed the words dramatically for only my mother to see. "Tell him to get it himself." With me there as support, Mom held her head high and proudly called back, "Get it yourself, Nick." My father turned around quickly, his face a red flame. He stared at her with his mouth open, then calmed down, looked over at me and pointed. You, I know you were behind this. I shrugged my shoulders and smiled. My mother laughed all the way to the coffee pot. She poured a cup and laid it on the TV table next to him. I just shook my head. Despite my father's opinion that my career choices as an artist, writer, and teacher would never bring in large amounts of money, I've managed to get myself to Italy and other countries in Europe numerous times. Of course, he attributes this to Stu's income, even though that's not always been the case. Twice I have traveled with my husband to Italy. Stu likes to brag about how I could get us through the country with what he thinks is good Italian. But even Stu always said that he would only travel to Sicily if my father agreed to go, since the language barrier is more challenging in the smaller paesi or villages on the island. So, during Easter weekend of 2000, while driving from our home outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, to see my parents in Syracuse, New York, Stu and I conjured up a plan to trick my father into going to Sicily. Knowing how vital money is to the Italian mindset, we were about to make my father an offer he'd hate to refuse. "Dad, want to go to Sicily with us?" I asked soon after we arrived. He responded with one of his usual smart remarks. "Only if you pay." "You're on, Dad." Speechless, which was rare for Dad, he stood smiling. Even though he can be a curmudgeon at times, I also knew my father's generous spirit would never allow us to pay for everything. My response intrigued him. "You're going to pay my way?" he asked. "We'll pay if you go." "Your mother, too?" "Of course," I said, and looked over toward Mom, standing at the stove, stirring a pot of boiling pasta. She scrunched her face in uncertainty. Wrinkles in her forehead appeared. Her mouth turned into a half smile. "You game, Mom?" I asked. "Whatever your father says," she replied.
Okay, so you tricked him with an offer he'd hate to refuse, a little nod to the Godfather, perhaps?
Yeah, a little nod. Just a little, you
just
know.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Just for fun.
Throw that in. Yeah.
Now,
you had it looks like you had kind of a complicated relationship with your father. On the one hand, you kind of went at it, but then as I read the book, I sort of got the impression that you started to realize that you were more like your father than perhaps you'd realized.
Yeah, I did. Oh, uh-huh. Yes. I mean, and when we were on the trip, my...
Fiery, stubborn.
Yeah.
Sometimes, right?
Sometimes, yeah. Fiery. Fiery, definitely, yeah, fiery, from Dad. And I guess stubborn, that could be.
I bear some of those stubborn traits, too.
We all do.
But you also talk about, as part of this fiery relationship, arguing over women's issues, but also noticed in the book a place about the middle of the book where you sort of came to this idea that your father had sort of prepared you to be this person you are because he didn't want you to be dependent on a man. I think you talked about that in your book. He wanted his girls to be self-sufficient, not beholden to someone. And you started to reflect, well, maybe he sort of prepared me to be this person that I am.
Yeah, I think that's true. But it took me a lifetime to get there.
And it took you 20 years to, as you said, get him to go. And then I think you told me it took you about 20 years to write the book.
No, my book took 9 years.
9 years. Okay, yeah. Half that time, yeah. And talk about that just a second, because all this was bubbling around in your head. It was a trip you wanted to take. I think you were probably making notes as you were there just to keep track of what was going on.
Yes.
So, and you're a very accomplished writer, poet. Why did it take you 9 years?
Well, I'm also an obsessive editor. My students will tell you that. I'm a bit of an obsessive editor. And I wanted it to, it needed to process.
Do we still need to edit some of it now?
Actually, yes. I found some edits. You know, the second time.
You need to put it down. My editor said to me one time, Landis, enough's enough.
You
got to get to that point, right?
Well, my publisher said that to me. Yeah. She said, no, we're not editing. One more thing. We're done. We are done. But I have found things, Landis, that I would go back and fix. But I'm on to other things in terms of writing, not in terms of the energy of this book, because it just keeps living with me. You know, it's so much a part of my foundation. Yeah. And it gives me an opportunity to be living with my dad when I work with this book. So it's been a great experience to have this book.
How did he take to the book?
Oh, I hadn't told you this story. Yeah.
You might have told me, you hadn't told the listeners.
Oh, okay, I'll tell the listeners. Okay, so I gave the book to both my mother and my father and Stu, the four main characters, to read. And one day he was sitting in that same recliner that I mentioned, and he looked over at my mother. He said, my mother told me this, of course, "Mary, what is she talking about? This isn't the trip that we took." And she said, "Nick, this is Gilda's version of the trip." And he said, "Oh." So he closed it because he had come to the end. He closed it and he said to her, "Well, then what's taken her so long to get it published?" Because he's all business and he's about that kind of thing.
Like, why are you going to be a writer? Why are you going to do art? How are you going to pay your bills?
Well, he was okay about the writing because I never ever told him what I made on writing.
Right.
Good thing, right?
Right.
Especially poetry. And so he just wanted me to get it out, and he was really thrilled it was out.
Well, speaking of money, let's make a little segue here into a scene where you make him proud about your negotiating abilities.
Segue. Okay. Okay, so this is pre-Euro. Italy was still using lira at the time. Minutes after walking into the Da Vinci Airport early morning Rome time, my father tries to track down a cousin he was told worked there. When a man in baggage claim says there are hundreds of people who work at the airport, Dad gives up. We stop at the money exchange and trade some American traveler's checks for lira. Before long, I'm bartering for a taxi into the city with the first driver who meets us at the swinging doors. His quote, 175,000 lira, or $82.50, will take us to any hotel near the Vaticano. I walk away. The guy puts his hands on his hips and pushes his chin out. Then he starts calling after me in English with a heavy Italian accent. I flip around and lash back in my fractured dialecto, or dialect. We paid half that amount the last time we visited Rome, I said. It was only Stu and me, not four of us, but even then, I thought we were ripped off. Since I've done my share of negotiating in Italy before, there is no way I'm giving this taxi driver the upper hand. My father could arrange the deal in Italian, but he's not the barterer that I am. Growing up, I learned how to bargain from my mother's mother, my grandmother, Nonna Egidia, and it comes back when needed, at flea markets, antique stores, and especially when traveling in Italy. The driver walks over and tries to appeal to my father in the sense of patriarchy rooted in Dad's DNA. It's the way the Italian male mind thinks. Fathers, brothers, husbands, priests, bottom line, men are the only ones who could or should make decisions. When was the last time you were in Rome? The cab driver calls after me when I turn away, as if I owe him, a complete stranger, an explanation. The guy quickly engages my father in conversation. raises his hand to his head and turns his finger around his temple, indicating to my own parent that I must be patsa or crazy. Instead of defending me, my father walks over, trying to reconcile in favor of the driver. I'm offended, but I don't have time to deal with it right now. By the time Dad reaches me, I've already arranged for another ride into the city for the four of us. The price? 80,000 lira, less than half of what the first driver quoted. Now, who exactly is the one that's nuts here, Dad, I say, glaring at the guy who is escaping into the terminal. My father's face takes on a look of delightful surprise when he hears the amount I bargained for. I must admit, I did catch a smirk on Dad's tired mouth when I was haggling with the first driver. Perhaps I misjudge my father, because eventually he tells me he's impressed that I have the guts to speak up. Now, speaking up, I learned from Dad.
That's good. How do you, that's... Only 80,000 lira. That sounds like a lot.
I know, doesn't it? It yeah. sounds like a lot.
How do they keep track? You know, it's
oh, hard. It was hard during those times. Although my mind might have been a little younger and fresher, but it was hard. You know, the euro's much easier, and I was always counting fingers and toes and figuring out how much it cost. But I always had remembered what we had paid, and I was offended, so I wasn't going to let them get me this time.
Now, this book, of course, in your background in writing and teaching has led you to teach memoir. And I'm curious, was it hard for you to write this story about your family? I mean, you're putting things out there, many of which are personal items that no one would ever know about except your closest friends. And now they're on the pages for everyone to see.
I know. Okay. You know, when I began to write this book, I never thought it was going to be a book. I went to my poetry group and... when I came back from Italy, and I wasn't showing up with poems. I was showing up with these stories. And finally, all three of them said to me, Gilda, write what's on your heart. I could not stop thinking about that trip, and I was just really obsessed with it. So, you know, when I wrote it, I didn't think I was going to publish it. So I just said anything. I mean, I said everything, and I didn't worry about it. And I've edited things out. There was one section that my publisher... I knew I was going to need an Italian American publisher for this. I just, okay. And she questioned it.
Okay.
And she questioned it two or three times. And so finally, we adjusted it.
How did your siblings take to the book?
My siblings, though, most of them were just, my siblings were all fine. But of course, they said, you know, that's not exactly how that happened. You know, everyone says that.
Right. Everybody's got their own perspective of what's real. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what I tell my students, you know, that when you're first in the throes of it, don't be showing everybody this because they're all going to tell you why it's wrong and why it didn't happen that way. And then later on, if you want to, I learned that from a memoir instructor that I had. So I'm just... very careful. But when I started this, Landis, I had no idea I was going to be doing this.
So I'm curious, you have the title My Father's Daughter, but as I read the book, I started, there are lots of places in here where you talk about your mother and also some things that come to you through your mother. How did you come to the title, and how did your mother take to the title being My Father's Daughter instead of My Mother's Daughter? Oh,
that's a great question, because I really wasn't coming into terms with anything with my mother in this particular book, I don't think. But my mother really came up with this title. And the way she came to it is there was something going on back in Syracuse at the house. My father was not feeling well, and so he wasn't making a lot of decisions. She was. And I called her and said, Mom, since I'm my father's daughter and he's not speaking up, how about if I tell you what I think about what you should do? You know, like I have a right to do that, but Italians do that. My husband is like, you're going to say that? So she said to me, well, you've been looking for a title for your book for a long time. Why don't you use that? Because I said to her, you know, since I'm my father's daughter, how about if I tell you what I think? And so I just stopped. Wrote the title down because my publisher and I had been going back and forth, and she'd say, you're close, but I was never there. And she liked the subtitle, and so I stopped, and she said, well, you're going to tell me what you think? I said, no, Mom, everything's all set now, thanks. And I sent it right out to my publisher. Within minutes, she wrote back, you've got it.
Wow. That's great. Well, you know, the book is it's a great journey. You know, I've been to Italy, but not to Sicily. Mm-hmm. And it's just almost described as sort of a magical place. I sort of got this vision. We mentioned The Godfather earlier. There's this scene where Michael Corleone goes back to the homeland, and he's walking around, and there are people following him, the woman that he's, you know, the chaperone and all this kind of thing, which you're going to read about in just a second, you know, having to have a chaperone. But it seems like a place that's sort of trapped in time a little bit, the way you just, I mean, it's not moving as quickly, right? Does time move as fast? And
it's really interesting. It's a great question. You know, in the villages, in the, especially my dad's, in the old, they call it the old section, they don't, it doesn't move as quickly. But the young people, they've gone out. My relatives who were young, they've all gone to the university. They don't call it college. College is high school. And they've all gone, but they come back to the roots. And there's parts that seem trapped. You know, the beautiful scenery. And the and what's different there, too, is like you can show up like we did. They will drop everything to see you. You know, here in the United States, you better call me first. Mm-hmm. You know, just don't drop in.
You dropped in on a lot of relatives.
Yes, we did.
And they immediately wanted to take you in and feed you.
Immediately, right? Yeah. Oh, my gosh, we ate more dolce over there, you know, with all the sweets. And and so they still adhere to a lot of that culture. Okay. Yeah, they still do.
All right, when we come back, we're going to dive into a couple of short vignettes that lead us into some of the culture and traditions and mysteries of Sicily. So be back in a minute.
Hey, listeners, quick break here to tell you about something that's going on with Charlotte Readers Podcast. You may have heard that WFAE, the local NPR affiliate, is having a PodQuest competition to find the next great podcast. Well, yours truly, Charlotte Readers Podcast, has entered that competition. And we're in the middle of fan voting, which they're doing on Facebook. It's kind of like voting in the old Chicago days when you could vote early and often. Although in this case, you can vote every day on Facebook. So check out the entries that are available out there. There's some good ideas, some tough competition. If you like what we're doing here and like to support us in this competition, please consider voting for us once, twice, or however many times you'd like. So yeah, we'll see what happens. Now, back to the show.
All right, Gilda, so there are a couple of scenes here that you have that's going to take us into the culture, traditions, and mysteries of Sicily. So why don't you, I'm not going to set these up. I'll have you read them, then we'll just talk about them. Start with the one, the morning where you arrive in Messina, Sicily.
Oh, okay. It's the morning after we arrive.
After you arrive.
Yep. We had taken the train from Rome to Messina. After breakfast and packing the car, we head away from the hotel and circle around a small piazza. Outside the window, I see a statue of Neptune, pitchfork in his left hand, two female figures at his feet. Stu is driving, my father navigating, my mother and I sit in the back seat. Friday morning, and we're heading out of Messina. I ask my father about the sculpture. "Oh, the giant," he responds. "Anyone who comes to Messina for the first time has to watch the giants. What do you call them, Mary? Pale?" My mother chuckles and whispers, "Testicles." I tell my husband that he'll have to do the washing. "And you too," Dad says. "Oh, no," I retort. "I've been here a couple of times before, but this is Mom and Stu's first time in Messina." Dad looks over at Stu, then turns his body around and glances at Mom in the back seat. "Okay," he says, "you can each wash one." We all laugh.
Okay. So we might have to put the old explicit tag on this episode now, since we're talking about testicles.
But, yeah.
So this is a thing, the statue of Neptune.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
and it's large? It's a big?
Oh, yes. It's in the big, it's a big, you know, throughout all of Italy and Sicily, they have these huge sculptures that have been there for centuries. Most of them are very Baroque. You know, they're very twisted and lots of beautiful forms. And that particular one is obviously an important one in Messina, but my dad went to a school nearby there, and so as we continue, he talks about the school. He thinks it's behind the statue, and so yeah, it's very they have wonderful piazzas in Italy. And
so the kids probably came up with this tradition, not the adults. Yeah,
you think
the middle schoolers?
Yeah, that's right, the middle schoolers. I'm sure.
All right, let's get on the train now.
Okay. we're on the train. Oh, yes, I'm on the train. Reminiscing about the time 15 years earlier when I was in Dad's hometown with his sister, my Aunt Mary, and her husband, Uncle Peter. Now, they're here. They lived in the United States, my aunt and uncle, and they were just visiting. The day before leaving, I wanted to cash more traveler's checks for my trip back to Rome. I overheard my aunt and uncle in the kitchen and realized they were struggling over who would stop what they were doing and walk me to La Banca, the bank. At that point, I didn't care what people had to say. I'd be gone the next day, so I walked downstairs, out the door, up to the piazza, into the bank, and back again in less than 10 minutes. When my aunt answered the doorbell, she was shocked to see me standing there. Neither she nor my uncle had heard me leave. "What will your father think when people start talking?" she asked. "Aunt Mary," I said, looking into her eyes, "I'll be gone tomorrow. You'll be gone in 2 days. You know my father. He doesn't care what other people think or say."
So what what time period was this?
This was in the mid to late 80s.
Okay, so still even then, a young woman needed a chaperone.
Oh, yes. You didn't walk in the streets alone. And so when my aunt...
Not because of danger, but because just custom. Right?
Yeah, custom and cultural. I mean, one day we were, when we first arrived in my father's village, Gualtieri Sicamino, we went to un bar. You know, that's where you would go get a quick cup of coffee or something. And before we went in, my uncle had said to my aunt, "Now, make sure she doesn't talk to anybody, you know, inappropriately." And so some guy said something to me at the bar, and I answered him, yes or no. Mm. And boy, they really sat me down and had to talk to me about it. You know, you can't do that. You're a married woman. Even if you weren't, you know, it's just not appropriate. And then when women walk through the streets, even now, they walk arm in arm. And they're very cautious. Even a cousin I met over there, who people thought she was a little more free, she was careful about walking through the streets.
So the idea that a woman who's walking by herself is more independent, I'm trying to understand how the reputational harm kicks in for a woman who's just walking by herself.
Well, I guess they're more independent. They should have a protector, I guess, is what they're thinking.
It's very paternalistic.
Sort of nature. Although, you know...
Misogynistic a little bit.
Oh, yeah, that's probably more like it. And so, and you know, when I was here in the United States, there are a number of stories that things I would do that, not just me, but my sisters were allowed to do that my father's paisani, they all one day said something to my grandfather is like, "Your father lets you girls do too much, like have a party or go out on a date or something like that." That was a problem for them. But my father didn't care what people said. So,
all right, Gilda, let's go to something about the culture in Italy that will speak for itself when you read this next piece.
Okay, sounds good. My cousin Carmela and her husband Nicola had phoned in an order ahead, and in a short time an assortment of antipasti begins to arrive at the table. There are platters of stuffed mushrooms, breaded and fried eggplant, bruschetta, pieces of round Italian bread with tomato and pepper, some with tomato and mozzarella. There is a serving of various cheeses and another plate of mixed olives, cured black, green calamata, and Sicilian green. There is also calamari, fried squid, loaves of Italian bread, melone e prosciutto, melon and cured ham. Such a huge selection of appetizers feels like another full meal, including artichoke hearts, potatoes, and roasted, grilled, and fried peppers. Bottles of beer, wine, water, and soda keep flowing as we keep eating. Our eyes roll with astonishment at the feast that continues to come our way. As our platter is half finished, another is brought over by a waiter, holding each serving dish high in the air, then swooping it over into the middle of the table.
Wow, I'm getting hungry just
listening
to that. And that's how it is, right? I mean, it just the food culture is, I mean, it's great food too, right?
Yes, it's great food. That's how it is. And that's how it is when I go home at Christmas and we have Italian. I just came from an Italian wedding. You couldn't have believed the amount of food. It was just lush. And that's how it is over there. It's wonderful.
So when my daughter was a junior in college, she studied in Perugia. And we went over for 1 week. And I was amazed that when you went out to dinner, the wine kept getting refilled like it was a water glass.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And the house wine's pretty good over there.
Well, they all do the house wine. Yeah. I have friends here in Charlotte, and he's from Florence. And he always says, I can't believe we have to pay for this kind of wine here, or, you know. But the house wine is great over there.
So one of the things about a book like this that you take 9 years to write, you've got a lot of pictures in it, which are nice. You've got pictures of your family, your father. I'm looking at this one. It looks like he's standing up, you know, one of those high Italian hillsides with the with all of the residences sort of staggered down the hill and behind him, and he's got his hand waved up and a little smile on his face. So he had a good time.
He did. That's his village.
That's his village.
Yeah, okay. And we're getting ready to go in, and we're taking pictures of him in front of the village.
Now, Gilda, I'll probably get in trouble for this, but I noticed that your hair color changed.
Dear.
yeah. But I like the new look. I mean, you got the dark hair here in the in
yes,
the book.
I yeah. did. Yeah. Time's gone on a little bit.
You decided just to give up and just
Well, it's actually, you know, now it's all multicolor, you know.
Okay.
That's the art part of me.
You just color to different whatever's suits, yeah.
Well, okay. it's really my hairdresser. She thinks of my head as a palette when I go in there. So
okay. All right, before we get to the last couple of pieces you're going to read here that are a little shorter. We're going to do something that I'm calling first draft. It's a short exercise to get to know you better as a writer. And the reason I'm calling it first draft is because, like any first draft, right, it doesn't have to be right. You know, it can be.
That's right.
Now, I'm going to give you two choices. You can pick one or the other or both or neither. And then you get to tell me why.
Okay.
It's just to find out a little bit more about you.
Okay.
But editorializing is fine. So just you can editorialize after each item if you like. So you ready?
Okay.
Ink pen or keyboard?
Oh, I love the ink pen. But then I go to the keyboard.
Yeah.
But I still keep a journal by my bedside. And
okay.
And I just love that feel of ink.
Yeah.
And then I'm fine once I get that out.
Poetry or prose?
Oh, that's too tough a question. I do both. You're never going to get a straight answer from me.
I said you could editorialize.
I do both. I just do both. And I think my poetry can be a bit narrative. Mm-hmm. I've been accused of that. I've been told that in my poetry mm-hmm. group. But I love both. I need both.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Nonfiction.
Morning or night?
Oh, my gosh. Well, ask anybody who knows me. I love the night.
Do you? You like to write at night?
I write in the morning, too, when I first wake up. But I can write any time, as long as there's time. You know, I don't have to be somewhere and do something. I love to. But I am really a night person.
Okay. Outline or free flow?
Free flow.
All right. Writing or editing?
Both. Right. I think I can be as a creative in editing as I can with...
Yeah, Gilda is sitting here banging the table. I told her to be careful. But she says her big Italian hands won't cooperate.
I'm Italian. We talk with our hands.
Right. Just don't talk on top of the table.
Okay, I won't.
Yeah, okay. So here's one. Library or Google?
Well, I do a lot of Google now. I always love the library. But, you know, in the middle of the night and you need a question, Google.
Dictionary or spell check?
Both.
Both, okay. Introvert or extrovert? I think I know the answer to this.
I think you'll be surprised.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I'm actually an introvert.
Okay.
I'm one of those types of introverts I've been told that...
You rise to the occasion?
I rise to the occasion. But not only that, it's like I really like people and I really care about people. And so that's probably why I continue teaching. And so I'm that type of introvert who... just cares about people and want to hear more about them. And so sometimes when I get home, I'm tired.
Right.
Yeah.
E-reader or paper book?
Oh, paper book.
Okay. Social media or personal appearances?
Oh, that's so funny. We had a conversation about that on the drive-in.
Okay.
I prefer personal appearances, but I do use social media.
Final question. Marketing or manual labor?
Oh, my gosh, I hate marketing.
So you'll do manual labor instead. Okay.
Well, what kind of manual labor?
Anything except marketing, right?
Marketing I find difficult.
Yeah, that's not unusual for writers. Okay, let's jump into two more pieces. We've got a short poem here you're going to read. It's called Juggling. And kind of to set this up, one of the things we didn't talk about is on this trip, the thing that I noticed was that your father liked to go to Mass every day, right?
He
did in his lifetime, right?
In his lifetime.
And when he was over there, he couldn't always find that outlet. So you were raised in a family where religion was up at the top of the list.
Absolutely, right?
And so we got juggling here where some of that sort of comes into the into play.
And I guess people will see where I went with that.
Okay, have at it.
Juggling. The juggler I watched as a child on the Ed Sullivan Show started with two white balls, tossing and catching, tossing and catching. My eyes widened when he introduced another sphere, then another, until his whole body flowed, round forms flung around his back, above his head, creating an arc from the waist up. Ball three. Yesterday, in conversation, I found myself juggling Christ, believe he is present in each of us. My colleague disagreed, thinks Christ is Jesus of the Scriptures, the Son of God. Ball four. A woman in the aisle of a health food store tells me of her flower essences, the pendulum she swings. Over each vial decides which essence a client drops under the tongue. She asks if I still study astrology, ball five, or if I've spoken to a mutual friend about the mystery school in the mountains where she learns Kabbalah, theosophy, numerology, ball six. More and more theories are hurled beyond the Catholic tradition I began with. Goddess worship, the healing team, channeling, medical intuitives. I've read the Gnostic Gospels, A Course in Miracles, Creation Spirituality, The Law of Life. I don't remember how many orbs the juggler tossed in the air. I thought he'd never let them fall, but when the performance was over, he did. You know, I really knew how my father felt about his religion. It was really important to him. And I remember being told a long time ago that when a person starts to get older, to start throwing those kinds of questions, it's almost not fair to them. So, I guess I could have asked that question for when I was younger. I didn't say a lot to my dad. It was so important to him, and I wanted to really respect it. I would sometimes say more to my mom about it. She was able to handle it, but it was just important to him. Oh, yes, I did struggle finding answers. You know, I say I didn't say anything, but sometimes I'd come out of the church and a sermon was going on, and I'd say to my father, well, that's not right, and I'd say something different, and then he'd go into his own sermon. Oh, boy, then, you know. But, yes, I did struggle. I did. I'm in a much better place, but you have to struggle to get to a better play. Racing and wives and Valentine's. The Daytona 500 usually runs the same weekend as President's Day and drags Valentine's Day along with it. It's the good old boys versus wives and lovers left at home. This year, the race falls the weekend after February 14th. Although many race fans spend the whole week in Florida, my husband and his buddies aren't leaving until Wednesday the 16th. Lucky for me this year, we'll be together on Valentine's Day for the first time since as far back as I can remember. I've never been to the Daytona race, but I've been to others. Grown men sit in bleachers watching souped-up cars following an elongated circle. I fell asleep once. It was the time we had back-row seats right below the enclosed suites. My husband likes to sit outside, hear the noise, smell the fumes. I plugged in my ear guards and rested my head against the brick wall behind me, while sounds of engines roared speeds close to 200 miles an hour. I heard a stranger's muffled voice say, "She's kidding, right?" And then my husband's reply, "No, she's definitely dozing, definitely. The drone drives her to sleep." Later in the day, he caught me staring at cumulus clouds creating an organic sculpture of white foam floating left over turn four. Everyone else was facing right, cheering screeching cars through turn one. I don't get it. Loud engine noises, belly belching, smells of gas and rubber burning, while back home, most years anyway, those guys have left behind chocolate and Valentine's. Last year, I was turning 50 the week after the 500. While my husband was in Daytona, I was home fending off calls from family and friends asking about final plans for a birthday party he was going to throw me up in New York. He'd been so busy firming up arrangements for Daytona that he left before making a decision on either the hotel or the restaurant for my celebration. After about the third call, I gave up answering the phone. I let the machine take messages while I huddled under the quilt in our bed reading about men and Mars. By the time he arrived home, I let him know exactly how I felt about Daytona. The numerous and repeated messages that I left on the machine for him only reaffirmed where I stood on racing. And that birthday party, he rescheduled and planned it perfectly last summer. By February 1st this year, he'd confirmed reservations for my birthday weekend for the two of us on Hilton Head, a place we've never been to before. I found a Hallmark bag stuffed in the bottom of his underwear drawer where he knew I would find it, and a gift hiding in the trunk of his car with my name on it. I guess whatever I said about my birthday last year must have worked. Lucky for me. Now he's still going to the race. Lucky for him. And with fate interceding, we are actually going to have a Valentine dinner on Valentine's Day instead of a week earlier or days later. Next year will probably be the same old story. I'm still not happy about Daytona around Valentine's Day, but as long as my husband makes as big a deal about my birthday as he does about the race, I'll be able to live with it.
Well, so are you the reason they moved the race?
I know. Isn't that funny? And but you know what? When they moved it to my birthday. But you know what, Landis? This year they're putting it back to President's Day.
Well, looks like Stu figured out a way to still go to the races.
Yes, that's right.
And keep you happy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this has been great having you on the show today. Where can listeners find your work? You have a website?
I do, GildaSiverson.com.
Okay, and your books, they're out there in the bookstores and online?
Yeah, they're in the bookstores online. And the book actually is in Kindle, but it's also in audio now.
You did well today reading, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Landis. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Well, that's it for today. Another fine author giving voice to their written words. If you liked our show, we'd very much appreciate your help in spreading the word. You can do that by telling your friends, or by leaving a review on iTunes, also known as Apple Podcasts, or by connecting with us on social media. Our social media links are at our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. And if you sign up for our email list at our website, you'll get a free ebook, a novel written by your host. And by the way, if you do sign up for our email list, we promise not to spam you, just send you periodic updates about the show. Next week, we'll have another interesting author read and talk about their work. I hope you will join us. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.